Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming on the web at ksfr.org and podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. And you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'd like now to welcome Igor Volsky. He's a healthcare researcher for the Center for American Progress and co-author of the book Howard Dean's Prescription for Real Healthcare Reform. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
So I wanted today to talk to you about the public option for healthcare reform, about which there is, I think, a lot of information, misinformation, and disinformation. The public option is a plan to provide a public health insurance plan for basically everybody who wants to join up in the United States. How would it be like and different from Medicare?
Well, there are several models for a public option, and I think the administration has made it very clear, all too clear, some would say, that they're considering all of them. I think the most popular model, at least amongst progressives, is an option that builds on the Medicare infrastructure. And what that means is it's a public option that functions a lot like Medicare. It uses Medicare reimbursement rates, which are about 20% lower than the commercial rates, and it requires doctors who accept Medicare patients to also accept the new public option patients. And the idea is that by inserting an option that pays below market rates, which many believe, and we have a lot of research that shows that oftentimes, and this is especially true with the specialties, oftentimes providers like doctors and hospitals are overpaid by insurers, which only encourages further inefficiency and waste in the system. So that by inserting an option that pays providers Medicare rates or Medicare-like rates, that you're able to compel private insurers to also lower their costs, and you engender real competition that then translates into lower premiums for Americans.
Private insurance companies have been fighting this partly because they say that they can't compete. Is this true?
Well, private insurers oftentimes can't compete because they, one, have high overheads, and two, they're not very interested in securing the best rates, the best premiums for their beneficiaries. Oftentimes, what private insurers do, in all across the country, where it's often just a single insurer providing coverage for an entire region or an entire state, is they pass on the higher costs of leading hospital chains, of dominant hospital chains, onto the beneficiary. So instead of saying to a hospital before that hospital joins the insurer network, let's iron out the best deal, like Walmart does, for instance, with its suppliers, private insurers oftentimes simply pass on the cost increases year after year to their beneficiaries without negotiating for better rates. And the reason for that is that the insurer markets across America, the great majority of them, are dominated, as I said, by one or two large insurance companies. So they have absolutely no incentive to compete, and a public option would work to engender greater competition and begin, hopefully, to lower costs.
I think the comparison to a big box store is an interesting one because a big box store, there's a bunch of them, and people can choose where they're going to buy their shoes or contact lens fluid or whatever it is that they're buying, or their chainsaws. Whereas it's very hard to even get health insurance in the first place, and a lot of people don't really have choice when buying health insurance.
We often hear that a public option is unable to compete with the private insurance because it would charge Medicare-type rates, or that it would have certain advantages that a private insurer doesn't have, for instance, like compelling all providers who take Medicare to also then take the private option. And I think arguments like that are very similar to arguments against Walmart or Home Depot, where, as you say, very large retailers are able to use their size to get the cheapest rates from their suppliers. And the argument is that a public option could do something very similar for healthcare without, and this is key, without sacrificing quality.
So if the public option is, and I have read some compelling arguments and what you're saying as well, that it actually has the capacity to lower prices to provide health care in a more affordable way. And we can talk about whether there would be negotiated cost controls and things like that. Why are some critics saying that it would raise taxes?
I haven't heard the argument that it would specifically raise taxes. The public option, as it's designed, at least in the House legislation, and as well in the Kennedy health care bill, would be self-sustaining. So the government would give the public option a one-time loan that it would then repay over a period of 10 years, but it would self-sustain through premiums. So I don't think it would have an extra tax effect at all.
So how would it actually work? If I signed up for the public option, would I pay monthly premiums that came in a bill or whatever to the government as opposed to paying it to my health insurance provider? Would it come out of some other – how would it work?
It would work like any other insurance company within the exchange, and all of the legislation before Congress sets up either state-based, regional-based, or national exchanges, and an exchange is like a new marketplace for insurance, so kind of like an Orbitz site for health insurance, where you, if you're a small business or you're an individual, you enter this new marketplace, and there's a certain level of assistance to help you choose the best plan for you. The public option is a choice among many. You'll have a public option and you'll have a menu of private insurance. And if you choose to enroll in a public option, you would work with it just like any other private insurance, and you would pay your bills to the new entity that runs the public option. That entity, again, is not the same entity that oversees all of healthcare reform. It's independent in some ways of the government, because we don't want to create a situation where the government is constantly bailing out a public option. We want the public option to in some ways be self-sustaining so that it has incentives to provide care in an efficient manner and to pay for care in an efficient manner.
It seems to me that if you start to look at the numbers, that if a lot of people signed up for the public option, they couldn't help but be self-sustaining, because we would pay our premiums, there would be a very large pool of people, and they would be able to provide care without having to make a profit.
I think that's right. One of the challenges in designing a public option or designing any kind of insurance, and you can talk to Karen Ignani, who's the head of the lobby that lobbies on behalf of health insurers or anyone else in the for-profit insurance industry, they'll tell you that the largest challenge they face is attracting a diverse risk pool, a pool that has more healthy people than it does sick people, so that the healthy people cover the costs of the sick people. And then once the healthy become sick, they too are insured. It's simply the way insurance works. And if you attract a large enough risk pool, if you have enough healthy people to cover the costs of the sick people, then not only can you turn a profit, as for-profit insurers would argue, but you could also sustain a plan, absolutely.
If private insurance were to become really not competitive in the face of the public option, except for specialty things, I mean, people who want to be insured for extra amounts of home care or sort of higher-end insurance types of things, would this become a single-payer system de facto?
I think under the designs that we see in specifically the House bill, it's very unlikely that a public option would become what many critics have called the Trojan horse for single payer. And that's twofold, I think, the reason for why we won't see a large very large public option. We know that private insurers have really spent years and years and years cultivating a certain consumer base. They have years of brand loyalty. It's the same reason why you have people buying Advil rather than the cheaper generic drug. Americans seem to prefer a certain brand, and I think the same thing would translate into health insurance. But also, if you look at polls, opinion polls, we know that about 83-87% of Americans like the coverage they have. Part of the reason, of course, is because they're not sick, so they don't have to use the insurance, so they're satisfied with it. But I think Americans are naturally a bit adverse to greater government involvement, and I suspect that very few would automatically kind of switch to this new public option. We also know from the Congressional Budget Office analysis of the House bill that the public option would attract only about 10 million people. So I think that this idea that it will become a dominant insurer is just not true. I think what we're trying to do is to make sure that that there's competition in the marketplace and to maybe weave out some of the most inefficient private insurers. But I think that private insurance will have a role to play. It will be able to offer certain specialty products. It will be able to be more responsive to consumer demand. So I don't foresee a monopoly for the public option.
I would think that unless there were very comprehensive re-regulation of the private insurers, that everybody would switch to the public option because they don't want to be denied care for the sake of a private insurer's profit.
Well, within the exchange, all of the insurers, in public, private, would follow the same rules. So they wouldn't be able to deny care because of pre-existing conditions. They wouldn't be able to rescind coverage once someone is using more medical care. So because they're playing on an equal playing field, a public option the same basic rules apply. And so while certain inherent advantages exist, like I mentioned, the private option would be more a private plan would be more responsive to consumer demand, while a public option would be able to deliver care at lower rates because it doesn't have administrative overhead, I think each would play a certain role in the marketplace.
Let's talk for a moment about administrative overhead. We're talking, by the way, to Igor Volsky, who is a healthcare researcher for the Center for American Progress. What is the comparison between, and we certainly have other countries to use as bases for comparison, but and also Medicare, publicly run health insurance versus private health insurance?
It's difficult to find an apples-to-apples comparison. The closest we can get is comparing administrative spending within the Medicare system. We know that in 2003, we saw a greater private role in Medicare through the form of Medicare Advantage, where private insurance companies began delivering care, especially in rural areas of the country. And the comparisons there are as follows. I think that Medicare Advantage plans deliver care with an administrative overhead of about, and I don't have it in front of me, but about 9 to 20% on average, whereas Medicare can do it at 2%. So I think the administrative spending and the administrative gap is significant, and it's one of the advantages, one of the inherent advantages that a public plan would have, that it can deliver, care more at a cheaper rate because the administrative side is significantly smaller. I think on the whole, industry-wide, insurance companies, private insurance companies, skim off that 15 to 20% of your premiums to cover their overhead.
I think the Medicare Advantage is an interesting example because that is actually putting Medicare, it's a program that allowed the private sector to say, okay, we're going to take over Medicare. And this mythology that the private sector is more efficient turns out not to be true, certainly in that example.
You're right. And we've seen that while we were sold a bag of goods in Medicare Advantage, told that, as you correctly point out, that finally the private industry would be able to deliver quality care more efficiently, we've seen that the opposite is true, that while we're overpaying private insurers who participate in Medicare Advantage on an average of about 19% for the same services that Medicare would provide, we know that seniors who are enrolled in these programs aren't receiving better care, and they're certainly not receiving more efficient care. We know from one GAO report that it's suspected that most of those government overpayments are pocketed by insurers in the form of simply higher profits.
What would be the ramifications, I don't know if you've studied this, but for small and large businesses who are currently paying for employee health insurance?
Well, larger businesses under at least four of the bills, all four bills that are currently out, we'll have to see what the Senate Finance Committee does, would have to provide coverage. There would be an employer mandate. And if they choose not to provide coverage, they would pay a penalty that would go to finance their workers within the new exchange. smaller businesses would be exempt from the mandate. They would be able to enroll their workers in the exchange from day one, and if they choose to continue providing coverage, they would receive a special small business tax credit.
So have you seen any kind of support or lobbying from business with regard to healthcare reform?
Business support has, I think, been substantial, and it's one of the differences, really, between the 93-94 effort, President Clinton's effort to reform the healthcare system. You may recall that groups like the Business Roundtable, the Chamber of Commerce, all the large employers, and, of course, the small businesses, which are represented by a group called the NFIB, were strictly against reform. I think this time around, the situation is really different. We're seeing the Business Roundtable releasing reports arguing that there's a certain value gap between American businesses and their international competitors, and that American businesses, because of the rising costs of healthcare, are losing out. And they're at the table, at least negotiating with the administration and with Congress to pass health care reform. I think that it's also significant that recently we saw Walmart, Target endorse the employer mandate, two very, very large employers. So I think that in the 16 years that that it took to get healthcare back on the agenda, business has really come around. Of course, we still see groups like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which is very ideological, running ads against the Democrats' healthcare bills. But I think if you talk to small businesses around the country and even large businesses, coverage has been eroding, and they want to make sure that they're competitive within the marketplace, and they want to see costs come down, and I think the majority would support reform.
Now, they are supporting reform, but are they supporting the public option?
That is a difficult question to answer. We know that large businesses, and these are the businesses that self-insure, are worried about a possible cost shift that might occur if a public option underpays providers. The argument is because a public option or Medicare would pay providers less, that providers, to make up the difference, would then turn around and charge employers and people with private insurance higher rates. And so in some ways, employers and Americans with private insurers would be subsidizing the public option. I think generally those arguments are overstated, and that if the goal of reform as a whole is to change the way insurers reimburse doctors so that they're not paying for every single procedure on a fee-for-service basis, but they're paying for quality outcomes, their payments are bundled for a single procedure, for a single diagnosis, then by changing the way insurers the way insurers pay providers for care, that we can really begin closing the gap and focusing on quality care. And the public option, along with Medicare, can really begin moving us in that direction.
I think it is a little, how shall I say it, ironic that Walmart is in favor of health care reform when they've been notorious for not providing health care for a lot of their employees over the years.
I don't think it's a secret that in supporting the employer mandate, Walmart is hoping for a facelift, for a PR facelift. And they also understand that they, by providing at least the minimal benefits that they do provide, and I think they've gotten better with time, Walmart's benefits, that they suffer a competitive disadvantage from similar companies that don't provide health care insurance. So I think the reasons for why Walmart supports health reform are interesting, as you correctly point out, but I think any support from the business community is significant politically.
We're talking to Igor Volsky from the Center for American Progress. We talked earlier this year to T.R. Reid, whose new book, The Healing of America, is coming out very soon, and we hope to talk to him again. And he compares the healthcare systems of many different countries. And one of them was really striking. The way healthcare is provided in Japan is that there are negotiated prices for basically every procedure. So an MRI in Japan, whatever doctor you go to, costs $98. And the doctors have to basically make a living within this book, which is kind of equivalent to the automobile repair book, you know, a head gasket change costs so-and-so much money and so on. And that, for example, the MRI being so very inexpensive compared to ours has actually driven down the price of MRI machines from the suppliers. So, okay, that's just an example. And there are many examples of price negotiations that various governments do with their healthcare, their whole health insurance systems, you know, Germany and so on. How would, and I know that there's a number of bills out there, but how would it work in terms of reimbursing doctors?
Well, reimbursement, as I said, is a contentious issue because it really gets at the heart of health care reform, not just health insurance reform. I think in order to make sure that any health reform that passes Congress is sustainable, we have to lower costs. And in order to lower costs, we have to take some of the profit motives out of medicine. There's a great documentary coming out very soon based on a book by Maggie Mahar. It's called Money Driven Medicine. And in it, she makes the arguments that because our system reimburses providers on a fee-for-service basis, where they have an incentive to provide you with more care, we're at a point in our country where a third of all the dollars we spend on healthcare doesn't seem to provide any added benefit, any added value. That's about $700 billion a year. And the trick, and the goal, and the challenge of sustainable healthcare reform, is to identify that $700 billion of waste, so to speak, crudely, and to reinvest it back into the healthcare system. And in order to do that, you really have to change the incentives that providers have. I spoke about changing the way they're paid in terms of bundling payments, putting doctors on salary. The legislation now, in the House at least, would provide and establish certain models that work. For instance, like the Cleveland Clinic, where doctors are on salary, doctors work not as solo practitioners, but with a team of other providers. So as a patient, you would go into this facility and you would be treated by different specialists without having to go to different establishments and receive possibly duplicate services. So I think it's a very difficult question to answer for reformers. I think this healthcare reform now begins to tackle that kind of difficult task of reorienting the system so that we're paying not for quantity of care, not for every single procedure, but so that we're rewarding providers based on outcomes and based on quality.
Rewarding based on outcomes and quality, how is that determined?
Again, another very difficult question to answer. Presumably, there would be certain standards set, evidence-based medicine, for providers to follow. But I think the easiest way, and I'll just give you an example of a certain model, if a physician is given given a certain payment for instance, treating a patient with high blood pressure, then he may be given a bonus if his patient has positive results, has lower blood pressure after a certain period of time. And it's with those kinds of bonuses and those kinds of incentives for positive outcomes that we can really begin reorienting the system, not towards which procedure would net the most money for the provider, but which procedure would do more to help the patient. I think that's really there hasn't been enough discussion in terms of this healthcare debate, is how are we changing and reorienting the healthcare system so that we focus on care that helps the patient, not care that lines the pockets of insurers or providers or whatever the case may be.
It's interesting. I mean, one could imagine a whole revolution of dietary and exercise and all sorts of education about self-care. And I know a lot of people, including myself, who do quite a bit of that on their own because they're so afraid of getting sick and being denied care.
in the book, Howard Dean's Prescription for Real Healthcare Reform, we make that argument that real healthcare reform, as we argue, it not only requires a public option, but it also requires a certain level of personal responsibility. And of course, the way we talk about personal responsibility is very different in the way conservatives discuss personal responsibility. When they say personal responsibility in medicine, they really mean a cost shift to the individual. When we talk about it, we mean wellness, prevention, breaking down the barriers in terms of access to care so that you can catch diseases early and you have no need for the kind of chronic treatments that cost our system so much money. So I think every American has to exercise, eat better, the list goes on, in order to help lower healthcare costs.
It does get into whole new directions, which I don't know how much you want to go into, but I mean, I would think if it goes this way, the soft drink manufacturers are going to be very unhappy, because once people get educated that drinking 3 cans of Coke a day, you know, can lead you to diabetes and things like that, and people stop doing it, you know, there's a whole market that suffers.
Oh, I couldn't agree with you more, but I think in our system there's going to be a whole market that's going to benefit from preventive medicine that can help prolong life, and I think those are the real sustainable jobs of the future. But you're right, and the soft drink lobby has been very vociferous in beating back a tax on soft drinks. That was one of the proposals for financing healthcare reform. It would have netted about $50 billion over 10 years, but it sounds like, from what we're hearing from the Senate Finance Committee, that proposal is off the table. But it's a very interesting idea, and if you think about it, obesity, of course, and diabetes adds millions and millions to the healthcare system. So if you force people who consume those beverages and those sugars in high amounts to pay a tax, then in a way they're paying for their own care. You're discouraging them from using those substances and funneling the money into healthcare. It's a smart way to fund it, but the special interests, it sounds like, have really batted that idea out.
There are countries that have done healthcare reform in Europe, and one of the results is that becoming a doctor is no longer a path to wealth. Doctors become more like any other middle-class profession, like teachers and so on, whose education is paid for in many countries. We don't have that here, but they no longer become wealthy. How is the medical profession reacting to the doctors specifically, to various aspects of healthcare reform?
Well, I think doctors on the whole have been supportive of healthcare reform for multiple reasons. One of which is that nobody, I don't think any of the bills really take the profit out of healthcare, out of going into medicine. We do add more money into primary care. There's a serious primary care shortage in this country because primary care physicians aren't reimbursed nearly as well as specialists.
Right.
And so if you expand coverage to more Americans, you're going to have a greater demand for primary care. And since fewer and fewer new graduates are going into the primary care field, those are things that need to be changed. But I think doctors support healthcare reform because they're really tired of dealing with the thousands of forms they have to fill out from the hundreds of private insurance from the different private insurers. They're tired of retaining large overhead of secretaries and clerks to simply deal with all of these forms. I think they believe that it's time for simplification. And they also, I think, are very excited about something called comparative effectiveness research. In today's healthcare system, doctors find out about tests and procedures from pharmaceutical representatives. If they have the time, they try to keep up with medical journals. But there's really no unbiased source from which they can learn about how treatments work in comparison with each other. Is treatment A and treatment B both effective? Is one treatment more effective than another? Is the cheaper treatment more effective or less effective than the more expensive treatment for the same condition? And in the stimulus package that Congress passed, the president made an investment in this kind of research. And with healthcare reform, we're hoping to invest even more. And that kind of research can hopefully really save some money so that doctors are encouraged to prescribe effective, efficient, quality treatment that improves the outcomes in their patients, but that also is proven effective and doesn't waste money.
It's kind of shocking to hear that that doesn't already exist. I mean, there's so many scientific journals that study everything.
The research that compares treatments is very limited, and that field really needs to be expanded.
Very interesting. We're talking to Igor Volsky from the Center for American Progress about healthcare reform. So we've talked about some of them. What are the, when you look at not just the public option, but the entire package of healthcare reform that is before Congress now, the House passed a bill, the Senate is in some kind of process. What would you say are the main components of the whole thing?
Well, I think the component that receives the greatest amount of media attention, of course, is the public option, as we already spoke about. You mentioned the Senate. All of the bills, and there are three different House bills at this point, and one bill from the Health Committee, the Kennedy bill, as we now call it, all of them have a public option. The Senate Finance Committee, which has yet to produce legislation, they've established a deadline of September 15th for themselves, will probably lack any kind of public option. So that's certainly an issue to watch for. The other large areas of disagreement and contention are an employer mandate. It looks, again, like even though the four bills already out have an employer mandate, that this Senate finance bill will lack an employer mandate. And I think an individual mandate is also something that may be contentious for the most conservative senators. And, of course, I think the most important element of healthcare reform, and one that is often overlooked, is the idea of affordability, making sure that if we require everyone to have coverage, that coverage is affordable. And those subsidies vary from bill to bill as well.
Right. And so, I mean, there are always, just by definition, some number of people out of work. What happens to people who are not necessarily even just on unemployment, but are unemployed?
Well, if you're below a certain income level, and it, again, varies from bill to bill, you would presumably, on a sliding scale, receive government assistance in purchasing health insurance coverage. But that's the reason why that is so contentious is because that's the great majority of the cost in healthcare reform is subsidizing coverage. And with insurance costs and healthcare costs rising every single year, you can certainly imagine how it adds up to $1 trillion rather quickly. We know in the House bill that subsidies, affordability subsidies, make up about $700 billion of the entire $1 trillion cost.
Hey, that's exactly equal to the amount of waste that you talked about a few minutes ago.
That's right. But that's $700 billion over 10 years. In terms of subsidies, the $700 billion in waste, that's a number for every single year.
Every single year. Amazing. The insurance companies are spending our premiums lobbying against certain aspects of health care reform. What has been their strategy?
They're spending a lot of money. In the second quarter alone, they spent about $1.4 million lobbying representatives. Their strategy, I would argue, is a smart one. As I mentioned, AHIP, America's Health Insurance Plans, which is the major lobby of the insurers, the private health insurers, it's headed by a woman, Karen Ignani, who's very smart, very able, and incredibly well articulate. She, from the very beginning, starting in December, proposed their own health care reform package that looks in some ways a lot like what actually the Senate Finance Committee is considering. It doesn't have a public option. It doesn't have an employer mandate, but it does have an individual mandate and an expansion of Medicaid. And I think for the non-policy wonks listening, the best way to explain their their bill is a buyout for private insurers. That is, they want every American to buy their product, and they want the government to help pay for it in the form of subsidies.
Okay.
They want poorer Americans, who tend to be more sick and more expensive, to go into Medicaid so they don't have to deal with them. But for middle-class Americans, they want the government to require every American to purchase private health insurance coverage. And I think, actually, one of the more coherent arguments for the public option is that without it, you're really rewarding the very same people who got us into this mess in the first place and who created the need for reform, and that is, in some ways, the private health insurance industry. So they've set the mark on what they would want to see, which is basically requiring every American under the age of 65 and those who are above a certain income bracket, about 100% above poverty, to buy private health insurance. That's a very large subsidy to the private health insurance market. And they've said, we're willing to accept certain regulations, like guarantee issue. That is, anyone who applies for insurance is offered insurance. We will stop discriminating against Americans with pre-existing conditions. We will stop rescinding coverage as long as you exclude a public option and you require every American to buy our product. And so that's their public stance. I think it's a very effective stance because they sound like they support health care reform, but it's the kind of health care reform that would expand their monopoly and only boost their profits.
That is a very interesting and very important point, which I think is probably lost on most people. It's been puzzling to me, to say the least, that the Democrats, the Democratic Party, and people in favor of health care reform have not been able to sell this issue in a clear way, either as a social justice issue or as an issue that just basically speaks to people's experience, because everybody from every walk of life either has been denied coverage, is scared of being denied coverage, doesn't have coverage, or knows somebody who's been through some kind of healthcare disaster. And yet it seems that the people in care of real healthcare reform, including the public option, really haven't capitalized on that.
Well, I think that's accurate, and I think that's one of the criticisms we're now hearing of President Obama's tactics. Remember, he started selling health care reform by stapling it to economic recovery, by arguing that the only way we can kind of swim out of this economic recession is by reforming the healthcare system, because healthcare costs are the number one driver of the federal deficit. Which is all true and accurate, and they think that he has a very smart economists around him who are making this argument. And his entire strategy has been informed by economists. But I think that's also precisely the problem, that economic arguments on a macro level don't resonate well with the American people. And so we now see, especially here in August, that healthcare reform is losing traction, and that the president is having difficulty selling his plans, and so are the Democrats. And I think that when he comes back from vacation, that's really a crucial time for him to retool his rhetoric and to retool the talking points and the selling points, because while the economic argument is true and real, that the consequences of inaction are devastating economically for the country, they're not moving for the American people, especially when the opposition is making these very emotional claims about denied care, rationed care, so on and so forth. The president really needs to step up the moral argument for health care reform, and hopefully we'll see that after he comes back from Martha's Vineyard.
This is obviously a social justice issue on many levels, and, you know, we are the only country that even has for-profit health insurance, and we're the only country that doesn't think, I don't know whether it's some kind of weird Calvinism or meritocracy or something, but universal care shouldn't be a value. But it seems like this is one of the fundamental social justice issues.
You know, one of the things that now the late, unfortunately, Senator Ted Kennedy was very good at is bringing out that social justice aspect. I wrote an article about his death, what it means for healthcare reform, for Think Progress, the Wonk Room. Readers can read it at wonkroom.org, where I argue that his personal experiences with the healthcare system, he, of course, came from a very privileged family. We all know the Kennedys. But he was also a lifelong public servant. And as a public servant, he was entitled to federal health care that all federal workers receive. But that entitlement, I think, opened his eyes to the inequality around him. Often you hear Republicans, who are also recipients of the same kind of health care insurance, argue that it's not good enough for Americans. But I think Senator Kennedy took the opposite approach. And in one particular speech, he recalled a story. He was with his son in Boston. His son had cancer, and he had to have his leg amputated. And it was some kind of experimental treatment that, of course, was expensive. And after a certain point, the NIH, which was funding part of it, simply stopped paying, and the family had to pick up the rest. Senator Kennedy, of course, was able to afford the treatments. He had insurance. He had government-sponsored insurance. But the rest of the families that he met there at the hospital were not able to. And he tells the story in far more moving words than I can recall. But I think the basic gist is that they told him, we've sold our house. We've mortgaged our house. We don't know what else to do to afford these payments, which were somewhere in the area of $2,500 a month. And I think it's that kind of call to and that kind of spotlight on inequality in this country when it comes to health care that really brings out the social justice themes in this issue.
It also really should be bringing up a national debate that I haven't heard, which is what are human rights? What constitutes a human right? I mean, people, we know that we have a right to education. We know that we have a right to privacy, to bear arms, to speak what we want to speak. Do we have a right to go to the doctor when we're sick?
I think we do, and I think that's really the central ideological divide in this debate. You'll recall during the second debate in 2008, the second presidential debate, the candidates were asked this question, is healthcare a fundamental human right? Senator McCain said no. President Obama said yes. And I think that the opposition we're now hearing from Republicans is rooted in this very idea that healthcare is an entitlement only for the rich and for the well-off. It's not a human right.
Let's go back to the question of the public option. The polls that I have seen, and whatever you may think of polls, has something from 60 to 80% of the populace in the United States in favor of the public option. We have 60, well, now that Senator Kennedy has died, 59, I'm not sure what happens in terms of replacing him. But, we have a very large majority of Democratic senators, and yet what you read in the media is the public option just has no chance of being enacted. There seems to be a disconnect between what the people want, the representatives that they've elected, and then this so-called political reality.
Well, I think that's right. I think that when the president reclaims the support for the public option, or when the administration says that it's something he favors, that there, and when proponents of reform make the argument for why public option should be included in health reform, they don't speak to some 73 to 80% of Americans who, as you correctly point out, believe that there should be a choice between public and a private plan. They're really speaking to the 5-6 senators who are on the fence, the conservative Democrats like Nelson, for instance, Ben Nelson from Nebraska, or even Senator Baucus. Some have questioned his commitment to a public option. Senator Tester from Montana said the other day that the public option to him is no big deal, and he would vote for a reform package that excluded it. That's, I think, who pro-reform advocates are speaking to. That's who they're trying to convince, not the American public, because Americans, as you point out, overwhelmingly want the choice. But it's ironic that the 5 or 6 senators who are the crucial fence sitters who already have government-sponsored health care coverage are denying it to their constituents.
What kind of public movements, activism, do you see on behalf of the public option?
Well, not enough, I would argue. Not enough. We have a group called Healthcare for America Now, which is a grassroots organization. Democracy for America, which is a group established by Governor Howard Dean, that's taking some part in grassroots activism. SEIU, one of the major labor unions that's trying to get people out to these town halls in support of the public option, in support of health care reform. But I think, honestly, that the opponents of health care reform, who are very well funded by certain large corporations, have the ground game, and they're winning. And progressives are losing. They're losing because they're, for the most part, unorganized. They're losing because, for some reason, they didn't anticipate this second coming of the Tea Party movement, so to speak. So I think there's a lot to be done. And I think part of the problem is that to be for something, to push for a certain policy, and to explain that policy to Americans in a very clear way, is a lot harder than to be against something. And I think that's a challenge that progressives have to overcome if they want to see a public option included in healthcare reform.
If some of our listeners right now are interested in supporting a public option, what should they do? Whom should they link up with?
Well, a website worth reading in terms of grassroots organization is the Healthcare for America Now website, which I believe is hcan.org. Democracy for America, again, is an organization that's also trying to get people out to the town halls. But I would encourage listeners to educate themselves on the issues, to write to their local representative, and to attend some of these town halls before the August recess is over, because it's up to all of us to make sure that our representatives know that there's 73% of us out here support a public option.
Igor Volsky is a healthcare researcher for the Center for American Progress. He's co-author of the book Howard Dean's Prescription for Real Healthcare Reform. Thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR is streaming live on the web 24/7 at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org. We're podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Colors of Jazz.